Every dollar invested in space brings asymmetric returns, but that means every dollar cut creates asymmetric risk. Against a near-peer adversary, space superiority is the linchpin. Without it, we cannot deter conflict. Without it, we cannot provide vital effects. Without it, we cannot protect the joint force. Until we have built the infrastructure to achieve space superiority, the Space Force is a work in progress.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is The Downlink, a podcast about the intersection of space, the space business, and defense. Not just what's over the horizon, but what's happening above it. I'm your host, Laura Winter. Hey there, Downlink listeners. This week, the Secretary of the Air Force, that's Frank Kendall, and the Space Force Chief of Space Operations, General Chan Saltzman, engaged in what the strategic communications community calls strategic messaging. It's an art form because, when well done, it ties together and puts a bow on ground truth and policy with the White House national security and defense strategies. This messaging should convince every audience that the administration is asking for just the right amount of money and that those dollars will be spent responsibly, the value for money proposition. And to be fair, we should cut the Secretary and the CSO some slack. Why? Because as the messengers, they are straddling competing duties, the duty to provide best military advice with the duty to present the administration's budget pitch. On Tuesday, they delivered the pitch to the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense, and again on Wednesday from the main stage of the Space Symposium. That's an important conference and exposition in Colorado that draws tens of thousands from the military and commercial space sector. Those who have business with the Space Force hang on every word in the pitch, but so do spacefaring allies like France and Japan, and partners like India, and also strategic competitors like China. In a time of great power competition, narratives are also competing to retain the base of allies and partners and bring around those nations on the fence, but also to deter those entertaining a more belligerent approach. So that got me thinking about whether the pitch being delivered, the sobering testimony to a lack of time, intensifying threats to space systems, the critical need for new capabilities, and the growing responsibilities the Space Force has to ensure the space-enabled capabilities the Joint Force relies on are there as and when needed. So is that pitch supported by the White House budget ask? In the request document, it cuts the services budget by $1.5 billion in today's dollars and then caps the growth of the uniformed guardians to 400 for a rough total of 9,800. And not to put too fine of a point on it, the budget line for procurement, it's slashed by almost 10% before inflation. So what's the strategic message being received? We have Namrita Goswami and Charles Galbraith to explain. But first, a quick message from our generous sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by TE Connectivity. When the mission is critical, so are the parts. TE Connectivity's components are exactingly engineered, rigorously tested, and certified by major space agencies. Learn more at te.com/space. Now here's our conversation. Hi, Namrita. Charles, thank you for making the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be back with you.
Now, before we start, let's do a quick round of introductions. And Nami, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So my name is Namrita Goswami, and I teach space policy and international relations at the Thunderbird School of Global Management, Arizona State University. And I've also co-authored the book titled Scramble for the Skies, The Great Power Competition to Control the Resources of Outer Space. Great to be here, Laura.
Oh, and quickly, what are you working on?
So currently I'm working on a book on space power theory, where I look at how different nations conceptualize space power, as well as how they view space from a long-term perspective.
And Charles, what about you? And don't forget to also include what you're working on.
Great. Thanks, Laura. So I'm Charles Galbraith. I'm with the Mitchell Institute's Space Power Advantage Center of Excellence, where I'm a senior resident fellow. I've been with them about a year now, and that's after being in the Air Force and Space Force for about 30 years. And I had a variety of roles from acquisition to operations to test to launch to policy. And so I feel like I've touched a lot of different areas on in the space arena. I've written two papers so far on the need for counter-space weapons, as well as the importance of the cislunar race and why the Space Force needs to be involved in that starting now. I'm currently working on a paper talking about how small satellites can be used to achieve the theory of competitive endurance, not just from a resilience perspective, but also from a deny first mover advantage, avoid operational surprise, as well as responsible counter-space campaigning.
Thank you both so much for joining me today. And as you know, this has been a really busy 7 days for U.S. defense space policy. It was bookended with two harmonized policies on integrating commercial space capabilities. But I think the meat is actually in the middle, starting with the testimony of Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall and the Space Force Chief of Space Operations, General Chance Saltzman. You know, they gave testimony before the Senate Appropriations Committee on Defense. And for our conversation, we're starting here because outside of the White House, the Hill is really where the power is. Congress is where Kendall and Saltzman have to be very clear about what their organizations want and explain the why and how. And as our form of government requires open testimony, you can be sure that military attachés representing the NATO allies, other defense allies, partners, and strategic competitors have been busy relaying the SECAF and the CSO's words with their analysis. And that's what I want to get at with the both of you for this podcast. You know, what's pricking up the ears and how might this change the calculus of the US's, you know, friends and foes? And to start us off, I'm going to play two clips from Secretary Kendall's testimony on Tuesday. Again, before the Senate Appropriations Committee on Defense. It's a bit long, but the SECAF neatly ties together what I think are some key points for those who are listening. When you hear the Secretary use the acronym FRA, he's speaking about the 2023 Fiscal Responsibility Act. And when he says DAF, that refers to the Department of the Air Force, in which the Space Force is nested. Let's take a listen.
As I have testified before this committee repeatedly, time is my greatest concern. We are in a race for military technological superiority with a capable pacing challenge. Our cushion is gone. We are out of time. As we have briefed the committee at a classified level, the pacing threat moves steadily forward. Continued failure to provide on-time authorities and appropriations, as you both noted, will leave the Air Force and Space Force inadequately prepared. We know the committee recognizes this, and we appreciate your strong bipartisan support. Our FY25 budget request complies with the Fiscal Responsibility Act. We are requesting $217.5 billion for the Department of the Air Force, which includes $188 billion for the Air Force and $29.4 billion for the Space Force. The FY25 budget reflects an increase of about 1.5%, as you noted, less than inflation, Vice Chairman, over the enacted FY24 budget and does not keep pace with inflation or with the 7% publicly acknowledged growth of China's military budget. To stay within the levels of the FRA, the DAF had to adjust our previous plans. The DAF FY25 budget request seeks to preserve the momentum behind our modernization efforts, particularly the work on operational imperatives that we initiated and that this committee supported in FY24. In order to preserve modernization, we have marginally reduced procurement, and we have sustained our foundational accounts at levels we deemed acceptable, but no more. Because the Space Force budget is dominated by research and development accounts, we have had to marginally reduce the pace and scope of our Space Force modernization programs.
Just a minute or so later, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, she's the ranking member on the committee, she followed the opening statements with this question.
For each of our witnesses, but starting with the Secretary, please describe to the committee the area or capability where you feel you are incurring the most risk given the top line constraints.
As I mentioned in my opening statement, my greatest concern is time. and the pace of modernization. China is, and I've been watching China closely for since 2010, they have modernized in a way which is intended to take advantage of what they see as our vulnerabilities. And so they are attacking things like our airfields, our carriers, our satellites that we rely upon in relatively small numbers. They're also modernizing in the air domain and in the counter-space domain very effectively in general. And they are fielding quantities. We do have to respond to the quantities, as you mentioned. Unfortunately, holding onto increasingly aging and expensive to maintain and less cost-effective assets really doesn't help us with that equation. So when I look at the risk equation, I think we're in a situation where in the near term, the immediate term, we are at acceptable level of risk, and we have to emphasize getting to the next round of the next generation, if you will, of capabilities. We, as General Saltzman mentioned, we have got to have a transformative set of space capabilities. We need to get to that. In the air domain, we need to get
to. So now in terms of space power, what are the key takeaways, Charles?
Well, I think the first one was, and Secretary Kendall made this loud and clear, is that the pacing threat of China is accelerating at a very impressive rate. And the United States, while we still maintain an advantage, I think we are in danger of losing that advantage if we don't take the risks and the warning signs very seriously. And we have to invest in new technologies as well as new capabilities to counter the growing threats posed by China. And there's, you know, those threats are in two large categories. It's what they can do to our space systems to attack what they see as a weak link in our overall architecture. But even more troubling in many ways is their use of space to close their kill chain and hold our people, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians at risk in a space-enabled kill chain. And so what can we do to potentially deny them that closure of that kill chain so that we maintain some level of advantage in space and ultimately in the joint fight going forward?
And Nami, what do the major space powers, especially in the East, like China and India, you know, what do they parse from this?
Yeah, so I mean, to continue with what Charles said, I think when I listened to that and what Secretary Kendall was trying to communicate to the American people and globally were three very critical ideas and thoughts that he had. One is that I think he recognizes, as he said many times in the testimony, that time is of the essence. So what that means is that if we are going to lose out on time by delayed DoD budgets being passed, continuing resolutions that do not allow new technologies and capabilities to be fielded, I think that is going to create a disadvantage in the long term. And I think when I listen to that, what I hear is that if you look at, for example, China's reform in terms of its military, which includes air, sea, land, and space, started in 2013 under President Xi Jinping. And today, because of that continued support at the highest level, which included funding, reorganization of their theater commands, ensuring that space is integrated into the joint fight, as well as the theater command level capabilities, his perspective, and he made it very clear in the testimony, is that because of that long-term support in terms of budget, policy, and institutions, China has moved ahead. And I think that is something that he repeatedly referred. And then he also pointed out that because of this, China has achieved some level of superiority in terms of, for example, space, because they have fielded so many more satellites, about 900 is what he mentioned, as well as their counter-space capability. So now coming to your question about when China and India would hear such a testimony, China would obviously realize that the U.S. has a strategic key dissonance or disadvantage, especially because of the U.S. own institutional structures, as well as the fact that budgeting is not supported beyond a point and you have to depend on this continuing resolution. And I'm sure they're going to listen to this particular testimony and think through what their own reaction would be. Because if you remember, Secretary Kendall also pointed out that the most important and the most consequential challenge for the United States in modern history is China today. And that's a big message that China hears. What India hears is that India will now have to develop their own capabilities ensure that they develop their space-enabled systems, build their resiliency structures, while collaborating with the United States to an extent because of this uncertainty, for example, in terms of funding priorities, as well as this problem of continuing resolution. That's how I see it.
Now, for me, and I want to move on to what the CSO said in his testimony, is something that really pricked up my ears because it relates to one of my particular interests, and that is personnel. The Space Force is currently mandated to have a uniformed end strength of 9,400. With civilians, it tops out at around 14,000. Now, in the president's budget request, the number of uniformed guardians will increase by 400 to 9,800. But here's my thing. And Charles, I know you also have this particular interest because every time I speak with a guardian, they have a responsibility load that would be usually associated with somebody of a higher rank, right? I mean, it's just, they're just chocked full of things that they have to like be across. It's incredible, right? And that person with a higher rank would also therefore also have a larger staff. Now, people can grump about bloated bureaucracy and place the ideal of creating a lean military service on a pedestal. But as someone who has deployed as a DoD civilian and worked in defense policy, staffing really matters. You know, that is if you hope to get anything done on an acceptable timeline. And we know that the secretary is very concerned about time, right? Which gets to, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about personnel. So I was kind of taken aback by the CSO's response to a question from the subcommittee chairman, Senator John Tester of Montana. Take a listen.
For the record, except for this one, I want to ask it. General Saltzman, you talked about additional duties that were coming from other branches of the military. Your recommendation in this budget is for an end strength of about 9,800. First question is do you anticipate that you are going to get more duties, responsibilities, programs, whatever you want to call them, from either the Air Force or any other branch of the service, number one? And then number two, if that's the truth, does your end strength recommendations meet that challenge? And if it isn't the truth, does your end strength numbers meet those challenges?
Thanks, Senator. We are in a period of managed growth. We are certainly getting new missions. We're developing our own missions. We're getting them from other services. The trick is I don't want the manpower before I have the actual systems to operate. We talk about counter space, the ability to hold at risk the adversary's satellites that can perform space-enabled targeting against the joint force. Those missions have yet to be realized because we're still developing the architectures to launch, to put into place. But as those get closer and closer to IOC, we'll be building the squadrons that support those and fly those capabilities. And so the trick is not asking for manpower before you need it. And then once you start to ask for it, make sure you have the training pipeline and the accessions pipeline to account for it. So I'm comfortable with the level of growth that we've asked for in this budget. And I think that's going to be a continued managed growth over the next few years.
So, Charles, as I said, I know you think about end strength and the Space Force's ever-increasing responsibilities. I also know that the Space Force needs to get after how it's going to secure cislunar space. I think you estimated that there'd need to be roughly 200 Guardians just to do that task with additive growth of $250 million. So, Charles, what do you make of what Salty said?
Well, thanks, Laura. To be clear for our listeners, the 200 people I'm talking about were specific over a 5-year span for the cislunar mission. These are guardians that should be focused on that mission set because of the unique challenges of that regime and growth that we see happening there over the next decade. But what General Saltzman talked about was for 2025, the growth that we see in the mission set. The additional 400 people a year seems to be about right. Would I like to see the Space Force grow at a much more rapid rate? Absolutely. I'd also like to see their budget grow at a much more rapid rate. And as we've seen, the 25 budget actually is kind of a decrease in total dollars when compared. So there's a couple factors that I think General Saltzman laid out that I just want to reiterate for the listeners. One, you need to make sure that the people and the capability show up at the same time, at the right time. Because if you have people before you have a system for them to operate, they end up sitting around and you're wasting, you know, human resources. If you've got a capability without the people, then you've got hardware sitting around deteriorating over time. And neither one of those situations is ideal. So you need to marry the arrival of people and capability together. The Space Force, as I think many people understand, is they inherited a huge mission set from what was Air Force Space Command, as well as mission sets from the Army and the Navy. That in itself is a huge workload for the small number of Guardians. But now we're adding additional responsibilities to secure the space environment, which is something Air Force Space Command really didn't have to think about. And so that space superiority, that counter space capability, is an additional area of growth. Cislunar is going to be another area of growth, as well as moving target indications. And so as these new mission sets pile on the Guardians, the Space Force has to grow. I'd love to say, you know, per your lead into this section, that Guardians are typically doing the work of someone above their typical pay grade. I'd love to just say, well, that speaks to the caliber of the Guardians that are there and what they can actually bring forward, punching way above their weight, which in many cases is absolutely true. But there's got to be more than that. When you continuously send an understaffed officer at a junior rank to meetings, it's difficult for them to carry the gravitas of the situation and help make the decisions that are essential to move forward, not just for the Space Force, but for the entire Department of Defense and the capabilities that we bring to a joint fight and a coalition fight.
So, yeah, when I heard that, the one thing that really stood out to me was his testimony where he said that we do not have the architecture for counter-space capability as yet. Now, that's something that, I mean, for me, looking at, for example, China and Russia's policy, strategy, capability is a big statement to make, right? So if I draw myself from that statement and then connect it to the just released U.S. Space Force's commercial space strategy and the DoD's commercial space integration strategy, what I see is that, especially from the U.S. Space Force's commercial strategy, is that they do say that they do not require commercial space integration when it comes to combat power projection, electromagnetic warfare, and nuclear detonation detection. So they're not seeking commercial support, which means that they're not seeking commercial support when it comes to such level of counter space capability. Now I'm getting to the point, in a sense, that this is where what he said, where he argued that I do not need the personnel before I get the system. But then in my strategic mind, I think, but if you do not have qualified skilled personnel today to be able to utilize the hardware you get tomorrow, then you'll be wasting time once you get the hardware to do such activity to train and get skilled personnel, right?
Like a walking and chewing gum at the same time sort of issue,
yeah,
right?
Because
I have to say that when you said that, I was like, well, this is like a chicken and the egg thing, right? Well,
I was a little concerned when I heard that. I'm sure he has his rationale for that. Maybe he put it more in a classified setting. But at least when I heard it, because he said that the U.S. does not have that architecture as yet, and then to go on to say that we do not need the personnel today because I have to manage the current level of missions I have got, for which you are actually looking for commercial integration. And there are those missions, for example, satellite communication, space domain awareness, where commercial integration will help you, but it'll not help you when it comes to this counter space capability. For that, you actually have to invest in personnel today. Skilled personnel is so limited, right? And so, for example, when I think about China and how President Xi's gone about this, by the way, they also had very similar challenges and still do today. The ability to retain highly skilled engineering talent and science talent for their space force. They recognized that as a big issue. Voluntary employment and recruitment was going down. So what did they do? They actually passed the National Defense Law in 2021, where they made it mandatory for this number of personnel to be recruited at a particular age. And then they raised the age for scientific operations from 24 to 26. So they recognize that if you want to build personnel capability that can deal with counter space training, equipment, as well as deploying a particular strategy, they have to start
today. And also procurement too, right? Yeah. I mean, you would want to have people who are trained in these things so that when they do interact with either developing this, internally or going to the commercial sector to procure it, that they know what they're doing.
Yeah, so Laura, there's a lot, and I think we're conflating a couple different topics here because certainly counter space is not an area that we're looking for commercial to provide.
Sure.
Because there shouldn't be a mission set for commercial to go out there and take out adversary satellites. We don't have mall police, for lack of a better word, in space, right? We have a military presence. Let's just talk about counter space, and then we'll talk a little bit about more on the commercial side. To operate a counter space squadron, which is only about 50 people, right? So 1/8 of the annual increase in the force structure of the Space Force. There's already several electronic warfare squadrons out there in the active duty as well as in the guard, and so we can leverage those personnel as we move forward. The procurement of a new counter space capability, which I absolutely think we need. That's the paper I wrote last year really articulated that. And not just the end effect, but the entire architecture that needs to be robusted in terms of the intelligence, the domain awareness, the command and control, all of that needs to be increased. And I think when General Saltzman talks about we need a more robust architecture, that's what he's talking about. All of those facets. And some of those are already in place and growing. Space domain awareness, of course, has been a high priority for several years. And there are areas that we're increasing that. The establishment of the 75th Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance Squadron last year, supports the targeting of adversary satellite capabilities, whether that's in space, electronically, network, via ground, air, maritime. You need to have some level of joint targeting. And so there are efforts already underway moving the ball forward in all of these areas. And so when I heard him talk about the capacity of the pipeline to generate personnel that are ready, can only handle so much, as well as the receiving units that are still being developed and grown. That all made sense to me as someone who's been in uniform and been there, done that. Again, would I like to see it move out faster? Absolutely. But we are where we are in a constrained budget environment. And I think it's critical in the testimonies that, from Secretary Kendall and General Saltzman, the threat is out there. It is growing. The consequences of us not taking the right actions are severe. And so as a nation and as our political leaders, they need to wake up and hear this message, because if they don't hear it now, something very consequential will happen in the not too distant future. And then we'll be picking up pieces and racing to try to make up for lost time, which is very, very difficult to do. Now, on the commercial side, there's a lot of great capabilities out there in the commercial sector. On-orbit servicing is going to be a growth area in the near future. There's commercial space domain awareness that is moving forward as well. And so those are areas that I think are new for the Space Force to leverage, just like they've leveraged commercial SATCOM for decades now, as well as commercial intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, space-based imagery, like Maxar and other companies. Those are all great capabilities that we're leveraging. And so I know we're going to talk about commercial a little bit more, but I just wanted to make sure that we're not conflating those two topics when we talk about the end strength requirement for the Space Force.
Thank you so much for just sort of clarifying stuff. So now we're going to turn our attention to what the SECAF and the CSO said the next day. That's Wednesday at Space Symposium. Here, take a listen to this clip.
Last year at the Space Symposium, I enumerated many of the threats to U.S. assets and capabilities in space. I think it's important to keep in mind that they continue to grow. I don't need to tell this audience how much our modern way of life and increasingly the military capabilities of the entire joint and combined force rely on space capabilities. That reliance creates a target set of increasing interest for an aggressive pacing challenge with the intent to achieve its immediate goals by coercion and even to displace U.S. global leadership of the rules-based order that provides security and prosperity for everyone. When one considers publicly available information on space order of battle alone, it is possible, based on sheer numbers alone, to argue that China has achieved space superiority. Of course, there is a lot more to the military balance of power in space than numbers alone, especially publicly available numbers. As of January 2024, however, China had more than 900 satellites in orbit, over half of which have intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities to detect U.S. aircraft carriers, expeditionary forces, and air wings. These capabilities combine with a growing arsenal of precision weapons to enable long-range precision strike against U.S. and allied forces.
China has so, NAMI, you and I talk a lot about China in space, and so does Secretary Kendall. I don't think I have ever heard him say China could possibly be considered the superior space power. He could, of course, say this privately. I have no idea. Maybe he has said this before, and I just haven't heard it. But again, I'm getting confused about the administration's priorities here because the budget is where the rubber hits the road, and I just don't get that sense of urgency that he is relating in what the administration is asking for space and defense in particular. And maybe I'm the only one finding this confusing. So, NAMI, what do you think? And how will other spacefaring nations and those with space ambitions see this?
Yeah, I found that actually insightful from two levels. One is, of course, when he's talking about the fact that he made the statement that China has achieved space superiority, I think he probably means in tactical terms. So what he could refer to is China's diversified tactical launch capability that they have been investing for several years. I've written about this several times. The fact that they were the first to establish the Space Force as a separate unit with the People's Liberation Army Strategic Support Force, and also that they are actually training, as we speak, on anti-satellite weapon capability. And I think he also argues, both in his testimony and in his speech at the Space Symposium, that quantity really matters. So in terms of just fielding quantity, for example, the 900 satellites, as you know, he said that about half of them is for intelligence, surveillance, targeting, as well as monitoring U.S. aircraft carrier. That is where China has achieved a high level of competency and capability. In his perspective, that amounts to superiority. I think what he's trying to refer to is that because China has that capability tactically at a strategic level, that also deters U.S. response to a conflict scenario. For example, let's say in the next 5 years in Taiwan, or, for example, in the East China Sea or South China Sea. It restrains an effective response mechanism. What impact does it have, that kind of a statement? I mean, you already see the impact with the allied nations, right? So, for example, you have noticed that Japan, in the last few years, have very clearly wanted to build their own competency and capability in space. For example, if you read Japan's 2022 National Security Strategy, Japan argues that they, while wanting to build operational capability and interoperability with the United States, wants to build its own space domain unit, its counter space capability, extremely revolutionary for Japan, given its 1969 constitutional obligation. But Japan's concern is that if China has achieved this level of space competency, where they can hold their own response mechanisms to a limited a deterrence mechanism, the idea is that Japan would do everything to defend their homeland. You see India doing very similar capability development. India is not an ally of the US, it's a growing partner, but even India is starting to build its military space capability in the last few years. They have started their own defense space agency. They're focusing a lot on counter-strike capability. India tested an anti-satellite weapon in 2019. And now the conversation around India's strategic circle is that India really needs to scale it up and rename the Indian Air Force, the Indian Air and Space Forces, so that they build not just institutional competency, but long-term budgeting, so that they are independently capable of countering China's space-based support for geopolitical conflicts. So it has implications, and I think that's what Secretary Kendall was pointing out, that that level of tactical superiority, in his mind, creates constraints in response mechanisms.
Yeah, I agree that the Secretary was getting at the consequences of a China that could have a space superiority advantage. But not to mince words, right? I think that what he said was it could be argued that China has space superiority, certainly based off of numbers alone, but numbers don't tell the whole story. So there's a lot there in the nuance. And I think as the Secretary of the Air Force, responsible for both the Air Force and the Space Force, you're not going to get him to say China's better than us. I think what you're hearing is
he'd get
China,
skewered for that.
Right. So what he's saying is China is concerning. And is that concern, that level of concern, is growing. And if we don't take the necessary steps now, we will lose an advantage. And, you know, General Saltzman spoke at one of our Mitchell Institute events a couple weeks ago and outlined a 2x2 matrix. In the lower left, it was neither the United States nor China or our adversary had a space advantage. On the upper left quadrant, it was the United States has an advantage and China does not. And the lower right was the United States did not, China had an advantage and the U.S. did not. And the upper right was both had space capabilities. And what he argued was for the United States, the only area that we really want to be in is the upper left, where the United States has an advantage and China does not, because they have access to their capabilities, you know, operating in an area that they're much more familiar with. And so if they have a space advantage, or if neither side can leverage space capabilities, that gives them the advantage. And certainly, you know, we're seeing that in the testimony, again, with Secretary Kendall, as well as his comments at Space Symposium, that this anti-axis area denial that we've heard about for years, it's a real thing. And they can target our ships. They can target our aircraft coming across the Pacific Ocean to a Western Pacific scenario, whatever that might be. And if we don't take that seriously and have means to counter it, everything else doesn't matter because you can't get there to do the fight. And so what signal does that send to our allies and partners? There's a growing threat out there. And if the United States doesn't get its act together and put its resources where it needs to maintain an advantage, we're going to be relying heavily on our allies and partners to help carry that load. Because one of the best things about the United States is we don't go to war alone. We are always with our allies and partners. And that's a great strength. And it's one that we're going to leverage on the commercial front as well to help complicate a potential adversary's calculus of who to attack from what angle, et cetera. And so our allies, I think, have to hear this, be as concerned with the threat as Secretary Kendall, and not just rely that the United States has got this covered, but we're going to have to do this together.
Let me just key in on that for a second, because I think you mentioned something really important in that, you know, the United States does not go to war alone. But the United States has always had a plan, right? And the allies and partners always look to the United States and see the United States as the superior force and the leading force of which they will support because they're going to win and that they'll also take care of their equities, right, in their interests and and such. But things are getting kind of rocky out there. And if you just look at the Philippines, right, under the Duterte administration, that administration was getting a lot closer to China. Now we've got the Marcos administration, thankfully, and it is getting closer to the United States and really, you know, trying to, you know, reach out the hand of friendship. But if that, you know, administration changes, there's no telling. But they're going to have to choose who's right. going to take care of their equities.
Right.
Right. And that's where I start to get a little iffy when I hear things like this, when I think about strategic communications and you know, what are these sort of, you know, nations that we have, you know, relied on traditionally as partners. Philippines is definitely one of those. But then we've also got other areas that have, let's say, a strategic location in the South China Sea or the Southern Pacific, right? Sorry, I meant the Southern Pacific there. You know, there's been some problems keeping everybody kind of on board with what we're doing. And yeah. I think this could be kind of troublesome for that.
Well, I think we can never lose sight of the fact that there are countries out there that are looking to the progress of the United States and China and trying to figure out who to align with for their best long-term interests. And, you know, I talked about this in the Cislunar paper and how that is emblematic of the great power status of a nation. And so nations, you know, around the world are looking to them. We have a few incredible close allies that I think will be with us through thick and thin. But there are a lot of non-aligned or some that are maybe playing a little bit of both sides right now that are looking to see, okay, who has my best long-term interests either in mind or can help facilitate my best long-term interests. And we've got to be mindful of that. And it's not just from a military perspective, but it's also from a science and technology, an education, a humanitarian aid, you know, commerce. All of that needs to be at the forefront for the United States. We are a world leader, and we're going to continue to be a world leader. And I think nations around the world need to look at us, look to us for that leadership and guidance. And that doesn't mean that we're always going to be the first there. I was, you know, incredibly excited when India successfully landed on the moon. Congratulations. That's tremendous. I want to see more success like that because we learn from each other as we partner and grow because India, of course, joined the Artemis Accords. So that's just, you know, the Cislunar example is just one example, but across the board, there's leadership opportunities for the United States and partnership opportunities for a lot of great countries out there to join with.
So I think one of the things that I heard, for example, if I am in Africa or somewhere else, listening to these speeches as well as the testimony, right? So the three things that came out very clearly was that there was this great concern that the U.S. budgetary process was making it unfortunately clear that that was actually the result why modernization and other aspects of military capability was behind. And Secretary Kendall made it very clear that actually when you accumulate those effects, that could put us 5 years behind in terms of modernization, right? And the second important signaling in terms of international strategic communication was that the United States for a very long time went away from great power competition. And Secretary Kendall mentioned this in the Space Symposium speech, right? He said that because there was a focus on counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, the ability of the United States to understand what systems are vital at the level of great power competition probably wasn't there. So it's catching up. And then finally, I'll say that the U.S. is actually dealing with a particular strategic adversary that is not like the Cold War, right, or the Soviet Union. China had a head start in terms of reform, military capability. There are about 100 J-20 aircrafts that they have fielded by now across their different theater commands. So they are ahead, including in air power today. So whereas you could see that there were complaints from the Air Force Chief of Staff that Air Force modernization was also behind, right? So this signaling, while I can understand the domestic reasons for such signaling, also has international implications. And so I thought I'll bring that to your podcast.
Thank you. So, you know, I do want to stick to where the rubber hits the road again, and that's with the very cool policy ideas. I mean, they are kind of neato that don't seem to have money attached. And the CSO unveiled one of them at the Space Symposium on Wednesday. Again, this is going to be a kind of a long clip, but I think that the history that Salty gives is really instructive to those who are not, let's say, military nerds out there. And it uses a Blue Water Navy analogy. So let's hear his pitch.
During the Spanish-American War in 1898, the U.S. Navy relied heavily on commercial coaling stations to support its naval operations. The war fought in both the Caribbean and the Pacific proved naval power to be decisive, allowing expeditionary forces to disembark at desired locations, unconstrained by distance. These refueling stations in Singapore, Hong Kong, Honolulu, Manila, which were run by the Pacific Mail Steamship Company, the American Hawaiian Steamship Company, and the Oceanic Steamship Company, were vital to replenishing coal supplies during the war, enabling our naval ships to extend their range and remain operational for extended periods. And over the past two decades, the demand for military satellite communication bandwidth increased dramatically due to the heavy reliance on bandwidth-intensive operations, operations like aerial vehicle feeds, unmanned aerial vehicle feeds. To offset this demand, the Air Force partnered with Inmarsat, Intelsat to meet the rising operational demand. Now, these two historical examples highlight the spectrum of commercial connections to military operations. So whereas the SATCOM example shows how commercial capabilities can add extra capacity when needed, the coaling stations represent a more complete integration into military operations. The Navy's operational infrastructure at that time was not complete without the commercial services completely incorporated. In space operations, we have become more comfortable with using commercial capabilities to add capacity than we have with fully integrated commercial capabilities into our force design. It is this basic thought that has led to the U.S. Space Force's commercial space strategy. Now, first, I want to set some expectations for this document, released just today, in fact. If you read the strategy expecting to see the answers to the most challenging problems of commercial integration, you'll be disappointed. If you are expecting the document to outline how much money is available for us to dole out for each mission area, you will be disappointed. But if you understand that effective integration will only come about with a common understanding of our priorities, the missions where we need help, our proposal evaluation criteria, and clear definitions of terms to enhance that collaboration, I think you'll find this document useful. Useful as a tool to drive process change, to shift our mindset, and useful to see the Space Force's relationship with industry in a new light.
As Secretary of Defense, so, NAMI, you have got to see the correlation between China's civil-military integration policy and its licensing regimes that this U.S. policy seems to take on. In fact, even take this idea maybe even a bit deeper and into the space domain. And I know I've read about even having U.S. commercial space operations that provide defense capabilities. I've heard talk about having them co-located in the same operations center as Guardians. NAMI, how do you see this policy at the geopolitical level?
I think I'm actually quite impressed with both policies. I read them both in detail twice, so just to get a sense of what they are. I think if you look at the DoD commercial space integration strategy, what they're trying to achieve is to move away from the legacy mindset that everything that is required in terms of space has to be built by government entities, whereas you can have them at a much more scalable, cost-effective way when you source from commercial sector. And as you pointed to history, actually a similar model, which the DoD strategy points out, exists with, for example, the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, and the voluntary sea lift agreement to ensure logistics during crisis are offered by the commercial sector. But they identify that similar mechanisms do not exist when it comes to the commercial space sector. And that's what they're trying to achieve through the DoD, for example, commercial integration strategy. I think what is so interesting to me is that they very clearly point out, and this is where the U.S. Space Force commercial strategy is very clear, as to what are the lines of effort. For example, if you look at their lines of effort, there are four, and they point out that one line of effort is collaborative transparency, second is operational and technical integration. The most interesting is risk management. So basically pointing out that when you're going to integrate, so this is the key messaging of this document, especially the USSF document. First, it clearly identifies where they're looking for commercial space to come in. It's not unclear. They very clearly point out that there are certain activities where they are not looking for commercial space integration. There are certain areas like space domain awareness, satellite communication. They use a new term called tactical surveillance, reconnaissance, and tracking, where they're looking for commercial integration. So I thought it's a very useful document. And what is more interesting to me geopolitically is that they also identify their audience. Of course, they see their audience as USSF Guardians and the commercial space sector, but there is an international audience for this. The more important thing where I think from a geopolitical perspective, and I'm comparing other similar strategies, is that very similar to the Indian space policy document of 2023, where institutional clarity was provided as to which is the unit or the person in charge for particular line of efforts, the United States commercial space strategy by the U.S. Space Force very clearly states who are the units, who is the officer in charge. So I think this document, despite the fact that we might say that they have decreased budget, is still very useful because this did not exist historically. And I'll end by saying that it responds to one of my biggest strategic concerns because of Ukraine. I think these strategies are a response to Ukraine as well with what happened with SpaceX and Starlink, because both documents point out that you need to achieve integration with the U.S. commercial space sector and not just augmentation, especially in times of crisis, because they recognize that this was a big gap. And then they respond to one of my biggest questions I've always asked through my writings. What happens if a U.S. commercial space asset that supports military operations is threatened or there is danger? You know, the DoD commercial integration strategy says that if directed, they will come to the rescue, including offering threat assessments to this commercial space entity. So I think those two documents were much needed, and I'm glad that they were put out.
Yeah, I agree that the two documents are complementary and very important. They also remind me that last year, Space Systems Command established the Commercial Space Office out in Chantilly. And during that ceremony, General Guetlein, who was the commander of Space Systems Command at the time, talked about $4 billion a year that the Space Systems Command is investing in commercial capabilities. And most of that is in SATCOM, like we've identified. But based on the direction of these two new documents from OSD and the Space Force, it's clear that we're moving well beyond just SATCOM and tactical surveillance reconnaissance, on-orbit servicing, et cetera. All of these mission sets are going to grow as commercial capabilities. You know, I kind of like General Saltzman's historic comparison because, and air power, we don't really have a commercial air-to-air refueling capability that we rely on. It's the Civil Reserve Air Fleet that people think about. But in space, that on-orbit servicing, that on-orbit refueling may very well come from a commercial capability like it did for the Navy back in the 1890s.
And so, Space Force is investing in technology development for Cislunar Industries Space Foundry. And, they were recently on this podcast and actually also were with me there at the Air Force Academy a couple of weeks back when I last saw you in person.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I do think they envisage fuel depots in space to support tactical operations.
Yeah. And I think one of the most important aspects of these documents was the recognition that this all has to be done now. We have to be able to integrate these capabilities now and not wait for the balloon to go up for a conflict to say, who can we bring on board? We have to establish them as partners now, figure out where our limits and capabilities are, exercise with commercial providers in a realistic environment, either a red flag or something else type environment. And so that will increase our confidence in what they can provide and what we can rely on from them, as well as how it all comes together when it really matters. And so I think both of these documents are great. Glad that they came out when they did. I wish they would have come out earlier, sure. But this is great because I know the coordination process for documents of this type is incredible. And so it's really great to see them on the street.
But Charles, I really hate to be a pill, but I'm going to be a pill because I see a vulnerability here. And I do know that the commercial sector was involved in advising in the drafting of these documents. But the vulnerability that I see, that these are great strategies. I haven't heard anyone say anything otherwise, but there's no money. And that it requires money. You have to pay people who are going to be doing the integrating on the commercial side. I mean, contracts will have to be written with money behind them. Companies can't just, go to an operations center and play, right?
So, first of all, I don't think $4 billion a year is nothing. I think that's considerable, especially when you think about the total Space Force budget of just under $30 billion a year now. That's a sizable percentage of the Space Force budget going directly to commercial capabilities. So let's not trivialize the steps that are already being taken and the money that is set aside for these type of activities. Will that need to grow? Absolutely, it will need to grow as the capabilities from commercial providers grows, as well as the mission sets for the Space Force and hopefully ultimately the Space Force itself in terms of manpower, personnel, and overall budget. But $4 billion out of $30 billion is not something to sneeze at.
Oh, but it's only $30 billion and it sounds big on the numbers, but I'm just going to remind everybody that, you know, when the presidential budget request came out, the year over year inflation rate was 3.8%. So there's a real reduction in buying power. Honestly, I'm sorry. I'm being such a pill. I just can't help it. But just sort of bring us back to earth on this point. Sorry. I really care about it.
I'm disappointed in the overall the number as well. And maybe within the Department of Defense, it's time to take a look at how the DoD is spending its overall budget. Maybe other services can pony up some funds to increase the areas that we know are going to be absolutely critical in this peer competition, great power competition that we're facing with China. And so, absolutely. There are ways to make the Space Force budget grow, and it needs to. But the overall percentage going to commercial from what they have, that's sizable.
NAMI, Charles, thank you both so much for making the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you again.
That's it for this week. For your daily dose of award-winning defense coverage, listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report with Vago Maradian. And for the maritime domain, listen to Cavis Ships with Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello. And get your air domain news and analysis from the Air Power Podcast with J.J. Gertler and Vago Maradian. I'm Laura Winter. Thank you for listening.